What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Delighted to have you with us. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've never heard it before, let me kind of set the stage here for you. Imagine that you are, and you probably are, a non-Catholic, and you've got a question or two about the Catholic faith, but you're not quite sure where to tune in or go to get those questions answered. Well, that's why this program has been around for the last 11 years. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and then once you get that, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email, the address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski is our phone screener, Rich Jesse is handling social media for us. That includes texts and also questions that you would like to send to us via YouTube or Facebook. Just put your question in the chat screen. Rich will see that. He'll do a little quick copy-paste. We'll get it over to us here in the studio. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
Doing decent, thank you.
You're looking ahead to the weekend. It's never too early to think about the weekend.
Well, actually, I'm going to be with our good friends at Guadalupe Radio Network in Dallas, Texas this
Fantastic.
Weekend. So that's my plan.
A little quick up and down to... Bang the drum for Catholic radio.
I guess back and forth would be a better metaphor.
But, well, probably so.
Yeah.
All right, very good. Well, safe travels for you, my friend. Here's a question we received from Orde. Dr. Anders, I grew up Baptist. Father and grandfather were both pastors and missionaries. But after many years of intense study, I became a Catholic this year. You, Dr. Anders, served as a major reason for that. I thank you greatly for using your talents and knowledge for God. So my question for you, Dr. Anders, is if a mortal sin destroys charity of God in the soul, I'm paraphrasing from the Catechism 1855 and 1861, but an act of perfect contrition can restore that sanctifying charity even prior to participating in the sacrament of reconciliation, given all the conditions from the Catechism about perfect contrition. What is the mode or mechanism or condition or explanation by which mortal sin destroys charity in the soul? Yet, to manifest an act of perfect contrition, one needs to have love of God to effect sanctifying grace. God bless you, Orde.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. If I understand it, and I may have misunderstood your point, but I'll answer what I think you're saying. So, you know, when you make the act of contrition in the confessional, you know, say, God, I'm heartily sorry for having offended you,
yeah.
You know, in doing wrong and failing to do good, I have sinned against you, whom I should love above all things, whom I should love above all things. And there's a recognition there. And then this is the disposition of the Christian, right? That I come to recognize that the source and origin of the universe, the first principle of all things, including all that's good, true, and beautiful, that the highest vocation of my life is to be in union specifically with that highest good, right? And typically, this is a gradual realization in one's life. I mean, at a certain age of development, you just want to be in union with Winnie the Pooh, you know, and waffles and maple syrup. I mean, you have, you know, very, very simple and sensory experiences of the good, but eventually you come to realize that these things are good in virtue of something far greater, and I want to be connected to that far greater thing, and that is just what union with God means. And then to recognize that everyone has the same vocation to transcendence, and that's the source of their dignity and their freedom, and that I can know and love God in his likeness and image as it's manifested in other human beings, hence the love of God and the love of neighbor, connected to this transcendent vision of human dignity. And so, you know, when I act in a gravely immoral way that brings, you know, gross indignity to other human beings or denies the reality of God in my life, well, you know, then by definition, I'm not in union with that good anymore in the depths of my interior life. And an act of perfect contrition isn't just reciting a formula. It's actually directionally turning your soul back to the consideration of that highest good and genuinely affecting, not just wanting to at an intellectual level, but actually doing the interior work necessary to bring the direction of my will and my intentions back in line with that highest good that should structure everything in my life. When you've done that, you are by definition back in union with the highest good. I mean, our union with God is not just contractual. It's not verbal. It happens, you know, in our character. It happens in our intentionality as we aim at and seek to be reconciled to and seek to live in accordance with and to be conformed to that highest principle that manifests itself in all that's good, true, and beautiful in the world.
All right. Orde, thank you so much for your question and also for your kind comments about the show. We do appreciate that. Quick one here from Samantha. How can people justify the idea of women priests?
Right here, we're really not in the position, we're not in the job of justifying positions that the church says we shouldn't justify, right, or that aren't justifiable. So, I'm not super comfortable with the idea of, making an argument for a position the church rejects. But, I mean, I think typically people who argue for women priests have a very sort of functional understanding of the priesthood as, a woman is perfectly as capable as a man of, you know, standing at an altar, saying certain words, performing certain gestures, you know, over the elements of the sacrament, maybe even of offering pastoral care or management services to a parish or whatever. And if you just think of the priesthood in terms of those functions, I mean, there's no doubt that there are definitely women who are more competent at each or all of those individually than some particular man. Girls are smart. They're good at what they do. I mean,
sure.
An argument against having girl altar servers is that sometimes they do a better job than the boys, right? And they chase the boys away because they're much more competent at it, right? If that's the level of your thinking, then you wouldn't have an objection to it. But the church has a response to that and says the priesthood is more than just the sum total of the functions that the priest performs.
So much more. Samantha, thanks so much for your email. In a moment, we'll get to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. We have one line open. You can snag it, 833-288-3986. We invite you to journey deeper into your understanding of the Eucharistic ministry and understand the Eucharistic story of God's love for us from the Old Testament to the institution of the Eucharist. What have we got in mind? Well, we are talking about this new free ebook, The 12 Stations of the Most Holy Eucharist. It is absolutely free. You can download it right now at EWTN.com/Catholicism. EWTN.com/Catholicism. Do check it out. We have a number of free ebooks. Absolutely, it's a wonderful resource for, you know, believers and those like perhaps you who are looking for the answers to some of the questions that we all face. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Beginning here with Matt, a first-time caller from Florida, listening to us on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hey there, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Hi, so last night I was at an OCIA meeting. I'm an assistant there, and the deacon was out. He was injured. So the question got brought up about basically treating the body after the person had passed away and cremation. And so I said, you know, hey, just make sure that, you know, it's acceptable. Just make sure you're treating everything with respect. You're not separating the ashes. It's not supposed to be going on the beach and throwing somewhere and stuff like that. You have to treat the body with respect. And a little bit later, the class brought up that, hey, there was a first-class relic, I think a bone, in the altar. And then, of course, the question immediately after that was, wait a minute, I thought you said you couldn't separate the ashes and you had to treat the body with respect and that kind of thing, to which I had no answer. I was just stumped. I don't know, like...
Yeah, I can help you. I appreciate it. So, first of all, placing a relic in an altar, in the consecration of an altar, is very different from placing that same relic, you know, in an ashtray on somebody's mantelpiece. There's very, very different contexts. So when the church divides the bodies of the saints for use in the veneration of relics, it does so because, in St. Gregory of Nyssa's words, we venerate Christ in his members. That is generally not the reason that people would give for dividing the ashes of the cremated. You know, there are a lot of different motives that people have for cremating bodies. Sometimes they're quite superstitious. So you take, for example, somebody says, well, you know, Granddad really loved the Great Smoky Mountains. And so we're going to cremate him, and then we're going to scatter his ashes over the Great Smoky Mountains so Granddad can be at peace with, you know, all the little squirrels and birdies in the Great Smoky Mountains. Well, that's obviously a very superstitious notion what happens to the human soul and the nature of the body and its connection to the resurrection and so forth. Or, you know, similarly, if someone said, we want to take Granddad and we want to, you know, we got five grandkids, so we're going to make, five little flower vases, and then we can keep Granddad with us when we have family dinner and everybody gets a piece of him. And that's a very different kind of world, right, mentally, from someone that says, you know, this member is a member of Christ, and in venerating it, I am bearing witness to the Christian doctrine of the resurrection and of our unity with Christ in baptism, and I'm venerating Christ and his members. And so it's the intention has everything to do, and the nature of the use has everything to do with why one practice is allowed and one practice is disallowed.
Well, there you go. Matt, thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. And Pedro, we're going to go to line 5, if you would, please. Line 5 has Kevin. Kevin is in Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hey there, Kevin. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, Kevin. This is Kevin.
Hi there.
I want to, who am I speaking to?
This is Dr. David Andrews and Tom. How can we help you today?
Okay. So I want to talk about the Eucharist.
Great.
I'm born and raised Catholic. I've been listening to the Catholic radio station for the past 3 years in my car. I love it, but I don't believe that the body and blood of Christ is what the priest is doing transubstantiation on. And according to your own conference last year on the Eucharist, I forget what the percentage was, but it was like 40% of Catholics believe in the Eucharist. So how does that work?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Well, I, for one, was not in the slightest bit surprised when I first read the results of the Pew Religion study that showed how few Catholics embrace the Church's full teaching about the nature of the Eucharist. And there have been some subsequent studies that have said there were some problems with the methodology of the Pew study, and maybe they got the numbers wrong, and maybe the numbers weren't quite so bad as all that. Oh, that's immaterial to me. The point of the matter is I think it's fair to say that there are substantial numbers of Catholics that don't accept the doctrine. I wasn't surprised by this when I found out, because Catholics have been rejecting Catholic doctrine on other issues, well, for a very long time, right? I mean, when Paul VI came out in 1968 with his encyclical on contraception, Humana Vitae, that repeated the longstanding church teaching on the immorality of contraception, his encyclical was widely rejected by large numbers of Catholics, and as it continues to be to this day, and not only by individual Catholics, but by institutions And there were even some bishops' conferences that seemed kind of weak in the knees and a bit queasy in the stomach about it, right? Didn't come out with their full support for the Pope's teaching, even though it was traditional. And of course, you know, you can go back in history and find periods of time when huge sections of the Catholic Church dissented from Orthodox doctrine on a whole host of issues. So, you know, you talk about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Let's take one that's even more important than that, even more central to the faith than that. How about the divinity of Christ? In the 4th century, we had to hold an ecumenical council, the Council of Nicaea, because there were vast numbers of Catholics that didn't believe in the full divinity of Jesus. So they would confess it, but they meant something different by it than what the Orthodox meant by it. And even after the council, there were, you know, about another century went by before you got widespread agreement with the council's conclusion. So I wasn't very perplexed by that. And in fact, that opposition goes all the way back to the Gospels. In John chapter 6, we read that when Christ gave out the bread of life discourse, and he said, "My flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink, and whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has life," the majority of the crowds turned away.
Yeah.
So, not surprised. Not surprised, not surprised. Now, I do think it, you know, I cannot tell you, I mean, I can tell you in the technical terms of theology, but I can't explain the mechanism whereby the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ. I can't do that. That exceeds my rational capacities and everybody's. But I can remove some obstacles to misunderstanding, right? And that can help clarify it. So I think it's very important to remember that when the Church says that the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ, the Church acknowledges that the nature of Christ's presence in the Eucharist is a different kind of presence than one has in one's daily existence. And so it's conspicuous that the Church says that Christ is substantially present. It does not say he's physically present. Substantial and physical are two different modes. What's the difference? Well, Tom Price, my colleague here with me today, is physically present. I can, like the AT&T ad, reach out and touch someone, right? There he is. And I could, you know, he has shape and he has quantity and he has weight and color and, you know, odor and I hope I never find out taste. You know, all these things that are tangible properties of a material object are evident to my senses in the case of Tom Price. Well, clearly, Jesus is not present that way. And so when people say, well, he's physically present, well, that's actually not what the Church says. They don't say physically present because that's a different thing entirely. It says substantially present. Well, what's substantial mean? Well, in philosophical terms, a substance is something that exists like in the integrity of its own being. What I mean by that is, you know, like take my dog. You know, my dog is a concrete living substance. He happens to be yellow. You can't have yellow by itself. Yellow has to inhere in something, right?
Sure, sure.
You know, like that in which qualities inhere, that's what we mean by a substance, okay? Now, in our experience, you don't ever find a substance without qualities. Except in the case of Jesus.
Yeah.
And so you actually have a substance devoid of all those accidental properties, all those qualities, all those characteristics that would normally flow from the being of a substance, those are all absent. So you see the accidents, the properties of bread and wine. You taste them, you smell them, you experience them. But it's just the substance of Christ is present. And it's more than that, because not only is it just the substance, but it's the substance in a mode that enables the substance of Christ's body and blood to be in more than one place in one time. So Christ in his proper person, his physical person, if you will,
yeah,
is in heaven at the right hand of God. But he's multiplied substantially in all the consecrated hosts of the world. That's the Church's teaching. It's a little bit different, I think, than what some people think. And so, you know, the typical objection would be, well, look, when I pick this thing up, it looks like bread, smells like bread, tastes like bread, sounds like bread. So it must be bread. The Church says, you've got every one of those statements right but one. It is, in fact, the teaching that you cannot discern Christ's body and blood in any way but by faith.
Okay. Well, there you go. Kevin, we hope that's helpful for you. Thanks for checking in from Oregon. Hope that you're a regular listener, and keep it right here on EWTN on your local Catholic radio station. All right, a couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. Let's go to Patrick. Patrick is in Dallas, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question is, dealing with salvation or assured salvation, I understand that the Catholic Church does not teach assured salvation. And I was wondering about, is there ever a point that a Catholic would be assured of their salvation? And I'm thinking specifically like in the context of coming out of the sacrament of confession, and the priest has absolved them of their sins, and then they walk out and, I don't know, they're struck down by lightning or something right after that, and they're dead, they didn't sin. Would that be considered, like, without question, that they would be going to, eventually be going to heaven? I understand there's purgatory, but I'm just trying to reconcile assured salvation with within the Catholic teaching, if there's ever
A
belief of
that. It. So, Patrick, do you know somebody that is in a really good marriage about which the thought seems impossible they're going to split up? Like, if anybody's going to make it to the end of their days married, these guys, they're going to make it. Now, do you know anybody that would fit that description?
Sure.
Okay, sure. I hope it's you, right? Maybe it's not, but I hope that's you. If you're in a certain kind of marriage, like I am, if you said to me, Anders, how sure are you that your wife is not going to leave you? I'd say, I'm about as sure of that as I am of my own name, do you have the same level of certainty that Jill's not going to leave you that you have that 2 + 2 = 4? I would say, well, no, I don't have that same level of certainty. It's a different kind of certainty. It's a kind of moral certainty. It's not a mathematical certainty. It's not based on, an infallible inference from a self-evident first principle. But it's a moral certainty based on, my life of experience with this person, and it would take a, I won't say an act of God. It would have to take an act of the other guy, the complete destruction of her personality, right? Which I obviously don't anticipate, for that situation to change. That's kind of like the situation that the Catholic is in, right? Because in talking about salvation, we're talking about a future event. We're not talking about something that we possess the fullness of right now. And we're talking about our capacity to be justified, that is, to be acquitted, to be reconciled, to be recognized by Christ on the last day in virtue of our own personal judgment. Because remember, when Christ talks about the end times, when he talks about the final judgment, he's very explicit that no one will be saved because they said, Lord, Lord. They will be saved in virtue of having lived a certain kind of life. I mean, Christ explicitly says that, okay? So let's say I'm in the present, I'm speaking in the first person here, but I don't want to be presumptuous. This is just a rhetorical figure, okay? So I'm not actually talking about me here. Let's say that I am in the position of feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, giving drink to the thirsty, visiting the sick and the imprisoned. That I am not conscious of any mortal sins, that I despise and run from the idea of mortal sin, that I am in conscious communion with Christ in prayer, in fellowship, in acts of penance, in acts of charity, in acts of mercy, with all my heart, as best of as I'm able to discern, right? And I have no intention of ever walking away from that form of life. The Church would say, you have the kind of certainty that, say, a husband would have of the solidity of his marriage. Right? It's a moral certainty. It's not an absolute infallible knowledge of the future. The only thing you have to do to maintain that state of confidence is just keep on keeping on, doing what you're doing now.
Walk the walk.
Walk the walk.
Patrick, thanks so much for your call. Lots more straight ahead here on Call to Communion. Don't go away. And we are back with lots more Call to Communion here on EWTN with Dr. David Anders. A couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Hey, congratulations to another EWTN radio partner, the Great Trinity Catholic Radio, serving Carroll, Iowa. They are celebrating 20 years with us this week. Congratulations to Dave Pringer and Kelly Foley and their great team there at KYMJ from your friends here at EWTN. Do you know where Carroll, Iowa is, David? I know you were an Iowan for a while.
I don't. I'm afraid I don't.
You don't know the whole state.
No.
You need to get busy on that.
Well, you know, maybe they'll cap me back up to Iowa again.
And, you never know.
We'll see.
You never know. Let's go to Jennifer now. She is in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, listening on the great WQPH. Hey, Jennifer, what's on your mind today?
Hi there. First, I would just like to thank you both. You have no idea. You've actually helped revert several of my family members just by your program. So I just wanted to thank you for that. But I have a question for my sister. Her son attends a school, and they are teaching that there is no salvation outside the church, but also it's just a water-only baptism. So there's no baptism by blood or desire. And some other things, too, like that the earth is 7,000 years old and things like that. I'm just worried that is the first, the baptism by water only, a heresy? Is that something that, like, is very concerning to her child? You know, I think she kind of modifies the explanation at home, but I guess just wondering if that is a big red flag.
Yes, it's a huge red flag. It's an enormous red flag. I mean, you know, it's not your child. It's your somebody else's child. You don't have a right to tell them what to do, and I wouldn't presume to tell them what to do. But if I enroll my child in a Catholic school and this was the curriculum they were being taught and I found that out, they'd be out the next day. I wouldn't keep them in there for a second.
Well, in this case, it is not a Catholic school. Is that correct, Jennifer?
It is. It is.
It purports to be a Catholic school, right?
Is this? And I know it is who the founder. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Is it a private independent school? It's not a diocesan school. It can't be a diocesan school, is it?
It's not, because she called the diocese and they found them in good standing. It is one of the ones that with the Father Feeney, but they split off. And,
oh yeah, that's a baddie right there.
Yeah.
Feeney is you don't want to go with Feeney, to be sure. And so it's very problematic. And the child is going to be raised with a deeply sectarian and an irrational view of Catholicism that, in my judgment, is not only erroneous, but it's the kind of system that builds paranoia and hubris and a very, very bigoted attitude towards people outside their little sect, and is typically rather condemning of the tradition of the actual Catholic hierarchy of the Pope and the bishops, and, you know, is not really in a kind of genuine union of heart and soul with the mind of the Church, and those kind of environments are typically, you know, have opposition to the Second Vatican Council and to the ordinary magisterium of the Church, and it's just a big mess, and I would not want to have a child in there for 5 seconds.
There you go, Jennifer. Hope that's helpful for you. Thanks so much for your call from Fitchburg. Let's go now to Susan. Susan is in Miami, listening on her Alexa device. Hey, Susan, what's on your mind today? Susan in Miami, are you there?
Oh, yes, I am here.
Go right ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, Dr. Anders.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? Yes,
right.
I had a question. At the church, they offer, because I was hearing the explanation about the Eucharist, and I know he is in body, blood, soul, and divinity. However, sometimes they offer in two forms, two species, the blood of Christ and the host. My parents are elderly, and they, you know, rather not receive the blood of Christ because of medications they take. And are they missing out on graces, or am I, if I don't receive the blood of Christ? I know at another church they just offer, you know, the Eucharist, the host, not the blood of Christ. I just had that question for you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate the question. So, in fact, if you receive only in one kind, you are not missing out in any respect whatsoever at all. And for a great deal of the church's history, it was not the practice to offer the laity communion in both kinds. And in fact, the church declared that if someone says that it is necessary to offer communion in both kinds, and that's a heresy. It's called the heresy of utraquism, which means both kinds, both kindsism, right? And actually, the council, the Ecumenical Council of Constance in 1415, declared utraquism a heresy. It is wrong to teach that the laity must receive in both kinds. They are perfectly adequately served by receiving in one kind. And so you might ask the question, well, then why then have two kinds? And that's a very good question. And it is not, it really has nothing to do, or very little to do, with the act of the faithful receiving communion. It has almost everything to do with the act of the offering of the Eucharist to God the Father as a sacrifice and as the memorial of what took place on Calvary. So, you know, when you listen to the words of the Mass and the priest says, "We offer you, Lord, and look on these offerings and be pleased to accept these offerings," the language of offering occurs over and over and over again in the language of the Mass. But we're talking here not about offering the elements in communion to the faithful, but offering the elements to God in sacrifice. And the reason we have two kinds, the bread and the wine, is because they recall for us the separation of Christ's body from his blood. You know, you have bread over here, you have wine over there, would seem to evoke the separation of Christ's body over here, his blood over there, that is to say, his death, which is why the priest says that the Eucharist is the memorial of the death and resurrection of Jesus. It's an offering, not a bloody offering, it's an unbloody offering, because the victim is not actually killed or immolated, but it recalls, it memorializes that once for all offering with the shedding of his blood that took place at Calvary.
Susan, thanks so much for your call from Miami. Glad you're with us today for Call to Communion here on EWTN. We have time for a few more calls at 833-288-EWTN and a couple lines open for you. 833-288-3986. Let's go to Kansas City now where everything is up to date. Here is Anne listening on the Great Catholic Radio Network. Hello, Anne. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I was at work today, and I was talking to a new employee, and she said that she was raised Catholic. I go, "Oh, that's great. I'm Catholic, too." And she goes, "Oh, well, just sometimes I go with my grandma, but my goal is to be a Buddhist." And I go, "No, no, no." And she goes, "Yes, yes, yes." And then she, and I was like, I stood there with my mouth open. I was going to say something like, why do you want to be a Buddhist? And then she said, "I got to go." And she walked away. So what do you think is the best approach? I know that you had dabbled in it, Dr. Anders. What would be the best approach to talk to this young gal?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So Buddhism is just, it is the hip religion right now, man, in the West. It is the hip religion. And I mean, I can't go in a health food grocery store, you know, without finding some 12-month calendar that has images of the Buddha and pictures of women in yoga pants sitting serenely on mats, you know, in front of incense with like an avocado and a fern in the background. You know, I mean, it's just the imagery and the ethos that's evoked in pop culture about Buddhism and Buddhist techniques and Buddhist spirituality is just ubiquitous, and it's always. It's always represented positively, and then, of course, in contrast, those same media outlets typically represent the Catholic Church as a source of corruption and moribund patriarchy and all kinds of outdated and ignoble traditions and so forth. And so they never. There's a huge sort of propaganda campaign in popular culture to present the one tradition in entirely positive terms and the other tradition in entirely negative terms. And so that's got an effect on this dynamic. And you know, for those that want to separate themselves from the historic Christian tradition, this is like, hey, I get to have the comforts of religion, you know, without the inconvenience of a personal deity and all that kind of business, right? Other things that have made it attractive to popular culture, of course, is the allure of the peace of mind that would allegedly come in due to certain, you know, meditative practices, and also the the image of compassion that is projected by and often associated with characters like the Dalai Lama, and again, you know, the image of the compassionate Buddha and these sorts of things.
Uh-huh.
And by contrast, again, we're fed a nonstop litany of complaints about abusive Catholic priests and the Crusades, and, you know, if anything, Catholics are, well, they're not about compassion and blah, 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 and they don't have anything like meditation, and they don't have peace of conscience and mind and all this kind of business, you know. So that's kind of what we're up against. So, you know, I think that, first of all, it's whenever you're in dialogue with anybody, it's really important to listen first and speak later, listen more and speak less, and
yes,
to let them explain where they're coming from and try to really understand and to sympathize.
Sure.
You know, Hilaire Belloc said a long time ago that heresies survive because of the truth that they contain. And what he meant by that was that, you know, so somebody wants to leave Catholicism for Buddhism, and those are their stated reasons, you know. Well, I like the image of a religion that's, say, up-to-date, scientific, and it's got empirical backing behind it, and it promises peace and compassion and non-judgmentalness and all of that, and I could say yes to all those things. I mean, all those are positive values. The Second Vatican Council in the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, says, you know, the modernity espouses a lot of values. Many of these are good. And the Catholic Church is well within its rights to say, if you espouse a good value, we're with you, bud. 100% on that value. Maybe
yes,
not everything else here, but on that value, we're with you, right?
Right, right.
And so I think, you know, affirming the positive things that people want to achieve in their spiritual development is a deeply Catholic impulse, and to recognize that and to say, okay, well, you know, I can understand why you'd want to take that position. You know, there are some other things that ought to be thrown into the mix. One is recognize that you do have possibly a very lopsided and propagandistic understanding of the Buddhist tradition vis-a-vis the Catholic tradition. And unfortunately, a lot of Catholics don't actually know, say, about the Catholic tradition of contemplative and mystical theology that achieves many of the stated goals of some of these Buddhist meditative practices, but does so in a higher key, right? Because the ultimate goal of Catholic practice is not simply to subdue the ego and pass into nirvana, but actually embraces love as the highest human vocation, and one by which we can remain in communion with persons, right, who are not non-beings, but they're actual ontological realities that we face every day. And we're not trying to erase personhood. We're trying to affirm it and build it up. And love is the path to get there. And the arduous and difficult and meditatively intensive path of Catholic mystical theology has as its ultimate goal the passing away of everything but that love, right? And so, you know, there's a lot of truth in Buddhist criticism, but it pales in comparison to the fundamental truth of the Catholic prayer tradition, which is, yeah, you want to divest yourself of this attachment and that attachment and this misunderstanding and that false expectation,
uh-huh,
but ultimately in the service of the love of persons, person,
sure,
of God, the person of one's neighbor. And so a kind of a discovery, mm-hmm, of the riches of one's own Catholic tradition and how that can speak to some of these universal longings of the human heart, I think is really good. And another thing is that, you know, whenever people join any religious tradition, and even that includes Catholicism, because they have been given an idealistic and romanticized picture, disillusionment is waiting for you down the road, okay? Yeah. And my job is not to, I don't want to get on the air and just read out the dirty laundry list of bad things Buddhists have done, right? Even though that's the kind of treatment you get when Catholics are concerned, right? But do some research. And I'll just leave it at that, right, that a lot of the things that are put forward, right, as sort of distinctly Buddhist virtues in the modern world are actually features of a form of Buddhism that historians call Buddhist modernism. Sometimes they call it Protestant Buddhism, and there's a reason for that. But
really?
It's unrelated to the Protestant religion, but there's different reasons for that terminology. And it is the result of traditional Buddhist cultures encountering Western culture, Western modernity, and Christianity, and then repurposing their Buddhism to accommodate those Western values.
Mm.
And so that, you know, they hold forth like these are uniquely Buddhist, you know, and distinctively Buddhist contributions, when in fact they're actually the historical fruit of a dialogue between Buddhism and Christianity. And so, you know, if you were to travel back in time, you know, 500 years, say, to Sri Lanka or Thailand or something. And actually, if you look into like contemporary lay practice in many of these countries, and whatever your conception of what Buddhism is, if you go into those societies and you ask, what does the actual practice of Buddhism look like in those cultures? It doesn't look anything like what you're being sold on the magazine covers, right? And in fact, for up until the 20th century, and a lot of people don't know this, what's the most characteristic Buddhist behavior that people have stereotypically in their mind? It'd be meditation.
Sure.
You know, meditation. Lay Buddhists didn't meditate, like, at all, for centuries. And then in response to Western imperialism, there were some Burmese Buddhist monks that said, you know, we need to repurpose Buddhism and dig into the roots of the tradition and pull something out that can answer the Western challenge. And so what's come to be called the Vipassana movement in Buddhism, they took something that was an obscure practice that not even all monks did in traditional Theravada Buddhism, and they put it front and center as if it were the center of the practice, right? Lay Buddhism in Theravada countries for centuries was mostly things like the veneration of Buddhist relics, and the rote recitation of Buddhist texts as a kind of talisman against, say, temporal ills like sickness and disease and so forth, and then you know, formulaic acts of donation to Buddhist monasteries in the hope of attaining a more favorable rebirth in the future, you know, when they might actually attain nirvana down the road. But they weren't actually sitting around meditating, and not even all the monks were sitting around meditating. Mm. So, I mean, I could give lots of specific examples like that of what, like, the image that people have in the popular mind about what Buddhism is really is a kind of creation of the modern world, and without the influence of Christianity. Another one would be the movement of so-called socially engaged Buddhism. Well, look, and I'm all about the social engagement part. I'm all about people who are advocating for peace and poor relief and things like that. What they don't realize, and, you know, somebody like Thich Nhat Hanh would be a premier example of that. And he did a lot of good things, Thich Nhat Hanh. But the movement of socially engaged Buddhism is a very modern movement. And where does it come from? Well, it comes from confrontation with the largely Christian West that's involved in social action on behalf of the poor. And, you know, there were Buddhist reactionaries that said, we're losing people to this. We need to, you know, take a playbook out of the forces that we're seeking to counter. And so they begin to transform the face of Buddhism to make it look more like Christianity.
Wow.
You know, now, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a really good thing, right? But it underscores an essentially Christian vision of the world, which is that through the incarnation, Christ comes to transform not just Christians, but reality. I mean, the New Testament doctrine, the patristic doctrine, is the incarnation is the end of the old world and the beginning of a new one. And that Christ has joined not just my humanity, but humanity universally to himself and to the divinity through the incarnation. And that the fruit of that will begin to penetrate like leaven through dough. And so Buddhists become more humane. Muslims become more humane. Hindus become more humane. Jews become more humane as the sort of fundamentally Christian values begin to get seeded throughout universal culture. And, you know, a key example of that would be, or manifestation of that would be something like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Oh, yeah.
Which is of Catholic provenance, right? And so, I mean, yeah, there are Buddhist countries that say, hey, we're all about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Well, good. I'm glad you are. But, like, understand where that came from, you know? And and are there principles, you know, buried in Buddhist texts that can be used to sustain that, to collaborate with that? Of course they are. But they were drawn out and brought front and center, again, by confrontation with the Christian West.
Anne, is that helpful for you?
Exceedingly. Do you think I should have her listen to this?
You know what? I was just about to mention that, Anne. The podcast is available for you at EWTN.com/podcasts. Pedro will have that posted for you in the next couple of hours. And, you know, certainly you should be able to bring it up as early as tomorrow afternoon. Thanks so much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you in Kansas City. Here's a great way to wrap up your work week. Check out EWTN's News in Depth with Catherine Hadro. It's a weekly one-hour discussion of current events in the church, politics, culture, all this from a Catholic perspective, covering the underreported stories and clarifying the church's position on key teachings with a focus on the laity's needs and concerns. Do check it out. That's tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN radio and television. If you would like EWTN News in Depth delivered to your email inbox with details on each week's show, do check it out. You go to EWTN.com/in-depth. That's where you can sign up for it. All right, let's go to a quick question here from Oscar watching us on YouTube this afternoon. He says, since Halloween is just around the corner, it's next week, can you explain your thoughts about Halloween regarding Catholicism?
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate the question. Although, you know, keeping in mind that my thoughts plus, what, $8 will now buy you a cappuccino at certain coffee shops.
Maybe,
you know?
Nine, yeah.
You know, in other words, I mean, I'm just a guy. I just have my own opinions. I'm not the magisterium. I don't speak for the church, right? So you make your own decisions. You follow your own conscience, and you follow what your bishop says, right? Well, at the end of the day. But personally, I don't get really worked up about Halloween one way or the other. I mean, the origin of the thing is Christian. All Hallows Eve.
Yep.
And this is, you know, the eve of All Saints Day. And, you know, and if it pulled in some pagan accoutrements from the surrounding culture, well, you know, what Christian holiday hasn't? That's just par for the course with being Catholic in the Western world over 2,000 years. And, I didn't grow up Catholic. I grew up Protestant, but, pretty fundamentalist Protestant at that. But, you know, growing up, I participated in Halloween, and I guarantee you one thing I never wanted to do was devil worship. You know, I wasn't tempted to necromancy. You know, we said trick or treat, and we didn't mean it, because all we really wanted was the treat. I wasn't going to pull any tricks on anybody, you know.
Just give me the loot,
you know. And I think 99.999% of the time, it's a fairly harmless exercise. Now, you know, are there bad actors who use this as an occasion on that particular holiday to engage in mischief? Of course there are, but I mean, they're bad actors all the time on all kinds of things, and. You know, I think it's all the spirit in which you participate and what you teach your kids. And, you know, I was more worried when I had children that were small. I was more worried about Christmas than I was about Halloween.
Wow.
Because the capacity, and I celebrate Christmas, right, as a Catholic. But, I mean, the temptation to commercialize the birth of Christ and to make it about a fat man in a red suit and flying reindeer was I think in some respect I thought more pernicious, right, than the Halloween business, because it was more of a distraction from an essential doctrine of Catholic faith, right? And I told my kids growing up that, you know, Santa Claus was a Byzantine bishop who once smacked Arius across the face at the Council of Nicaea and did in fact give gifts to children, and that a legend had grown up around him with embellishments over the centuries and led to this nice little Norman Rockwell picture that we have today, but that was all there was to it. And, you know, we could participate in that with a goodwill and you know, lighthearted humor, but we knew it was all about Christ.
Not Santa Claus holding a bottle of Coke.
Not Santa Claus with a bottle of Coke. Right?
Very good. Oscar, thanks for your question. Let's go really quickly to Rosemarie on Long Island, listening on Sirius XM. Rosemarie, we have about a minute. What's on your mind today?
Yes, I'd like to know. I have a mezuzah, and I'd like to know. I've seen Jesus, walk through a door and hit it, and I don't know why. Do you know why he does that? And, can I put it in on my door?
Yeah, so, you know, a mezuzah is a decorative case that keeps a parchment scroll of biblical verses, and it reflects the, you know, in Judaism, it's an attempt to respond to the admonition in the Torah to, you know, write these laws on your doorposts. and you know, bind them on your forehead and carry them about you and so forth. You know, as long as one doesn't have a superstitious attachment to the thing and attach superstitious significance to it, I don't see there's anything particularly objectionable about it. You know, Catholics like to inscribe the initials of the three wise men atop their doors.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a devotion that's particularly associated with Catholicism. It's more associated with Judaism. But, I mean, it contains the Word of God. And if your sentiment is that I want to enshrine the Word of God in my house, I don't think that's particularly objectionable.
Rosemarie, thanks so much for checking in. Glad we could get your question here in the 11th hour as we are winding things up. Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Tom.
We do it right here on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday. Check out that podcast we were talking about by going to EWTN.com/podcasts. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on the Friday edition of Call to Communion. Until then, God bless.